Welcome to the Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. It's another solo episode today, and today I will answer some of your listener questions. Truth be told, I am running a bit behind on my recording schedule because I am leaving on vacation tomorrow at the time of this recording. So I didn't manage to organize with Jack as a co-host or another guest to come on and help me out answer these questions. This is why I'm doing this alone today. So you'll just have to bear with just me, but hopefully you still enjoy the episode. Before we get into it, a real quick, especially for newer listeners, please follow the podcast and subscribe to it wherever you're listening. I publish new episodes every Thursday, so subscribe or follow wherever you listen and leave feedback in the Spotify comments and the YouTube comments. And I also create a poll every episode in Spotify where you can rate what you thought of the episode. And this is something that I use as feedback to improve the show and understand what you like, what you don't like. And this way I can keep making the show better. So thank you for helping with that. Now let's get into the first question, which is from Matteo, who writes, "Hi Michael, I'm an athlete in the 25 to 29 age group, training for my first Olympic distance triathlon. My first triathlon was a sprint in June last year. Due to demanding job and general life situation, I can only train for around 6 to 8 hours a week, split between two swims, two bikes, and two runs of around 45 minutes each, and then alternating a long bike and a long run every other week. I understand that with only 7 hours per week on average, I won't be getting a podium anytime soon, but do you have any tips to maximize my gains in my limited time? Thank you so much, and congratulations on the podcast. I've been a listener for quite some time, and I love it." So thank you, Matteo. Thank you for being a listener. And to your question, I think that everybody who is in this situation with a limited amount of time to train, look at all of the people that are training much more than them and think that you're so far behind. But actually, when you've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands of athletes, like I have, then you start to realize that your situation is completely normal. Lots of people are training around that same amount of hours. And you can actually do quite a lot with it. Like you say, in sort of bigger, more competitive race, you won't get on the podium unless you're super talented, in which case you probably will get on the podium with even less training. But you can do a lot with 6 to 7 hours a week of training. That's the main first takeaway to this question. So don't see it as something to sneeze at. It's still more than 99% of the world population trains in a week. And I think that it's really good that you have the option to alternate a long bike and a long run every other week, because being able to fit in those longer workouts, it's something that's going to help you a lot to get that bigger endurance stimulus, bigger aerobic stimulus that you might not get otherwise due to the lower total volume and the low volume of individual workouts on weekdays. Now, to your question about what to do with your training. First of all, it's really great that you have the option to alternate a long bike and a long run every other week. Those longer sessions, it's going to be a great way of getting a bigger endurance stimulus that you will not get otherwise due to the total volume being quite low and the low volume of individual weekday workouts. So keep that for sure and try to protect that. It's not a problem that you just do alternate weeks of biking of a longer bike and a longer run. That works totally fine. Then what can you do? What else can you do to maximize your performance on your schedule? First of all, you're now training for an Olympic distance race. That's great. I would say that a first step to, if you want to really maximize your performance, your competitiveness, then stick to sprint and Olympic distance racing, because you will be at much less of a disadvantage or those distances, and especially sprint distance. But you can do both of these distances and see where you perform the best. It might be Olympic distance, depending on your profile. But I wouldn't rush to do longer distances. It doesn't mean that you can't do them. You can absolutely do them. But if you want to maximize your performance, your competitiveness, then that's probably going to happen at the shorter distances rather than the longer ones. In your training, then I would try to focus on quite a polarized plan. I think that generally works quite well with lower volume training. Basically, you could do one swim, one bike, and one run each week that has an element of higher intensity intervals. And I think that this would be more effective than doing quality sessions that are, let's say, threshold intervals, for example, just because you'll pretty quickly come to a point where you're doing maybe 25 minutes of threshold work, but you actually need to do more to get the stimulus that you need. You might not be there yet, but at some point you'll get there where 45 minutes isn't enough to get in enough of a stimulus. So this is why the higher intensity intervals you can get away with, not get away with, you, it's enough to do a lower volume and still, and you can still, that still provides a great stimulus that you can improve from. So even between 10 and 15 minutes of high intensity work could get you to a really effective session. As you get fitter and fitter, more and more that might build towards 20 minutes, even in some cases slightly above 20 minutes. But basically, those are still possible to fit into a 45-minute session if you structure it well. So a polarized approach there, and you might even have to do those three intense sessions in a week. You could rotate between them. So you do swim bike 1 week, then the next week you do bike run, and then the next week you do swim run. So and rotate through that sort of two really intense sessions per week. That depends a bit on how much you can tolerate in terms of intensity, simply. Then the second swim, bike, or run that you do each week would be a basic endurance session, zone one, zone two. But maybe you can amp up the quality a little bit by doing some more on the swim. You can for sure do some good focused technique work. And maybe even some speed work. The swim is an area where you can, of course, do more intensity, and it doesn't generally take so much out of you. So there you could do a mix of things, but I would focus quite a bit on technique there probably, and a bit of speed. Then on the bike, you could be doing things like aero drills, cadence work, those sorts of things, even some sprinting perhaps, depending on how well you've recovered. But some of these sessions is the point. You can include some other things. It's not to let, you shouldn't get away from letting the main thing be the main thing. And the main thing in endurance training is the endurance training itself. So it's fine to just do zone one, zone two work on the bike and run. But yeah, bear that in mind as an option, basically, to include some of these alternative sort of drill sets or whatever you want to call them, neuromuscular work, technical work, that will help you potentially get a little bit more out of those easier sessions on the run, doing strides, that sort of thing, in addition to the aerobic work that you're doing. But that's really a much smaller part of the question, so don't overfocus on that. I think that the main gist here so far of the question is the polarized training plan. I think that works well. It doesn't necessarily mean that you, in terms of frequency, you can still do those intense sessions quite often if you recover well enough. But with the higher intensity, because you have limited time within each training session. The big problem, though, with having a limited schedule, limited time to train, is not the time for training itself, but it's that what leads to you having a limited time for training is all the other demands that you have. So work and family demands, and you have to still be able to adapt to training while having these other stressors in your life. So what you need to think about as well is to be very flexible. You might have a plan in place to swim hard on Tuesday, bike hard on Thursday, and run hard on Saturday. But if you're under a lot of stress on any of those days and you just don't feel that your body is ready to do a hard session, then don't stress it. Then replace that intense workout with an easy workout instead and just move on to the next one. Because in general, when you have a lot of stress in your life, the best way of understanding whether your body is ready to absorb a big stimulus is really how you feel. And so that's what you need to do. And you need to be flexible and accept that not every hard session is going to happen, but you can still be consistent and do something, even if it's turning things into a very easy swim or bike or run. One final thing that I would say is that in the long workouts where you alternate the bike and the run, probably just do aerobic work, zone one, zone two, for the most part when you're farther out from racing. But when you're approaching your races, then you would start to add more race-specific work to that session. And maybe it even becomes a brick workout a couple of times before the race. So these are my recommendations, and good luck to you, Matteo. Now, before we move on to the next question, which is from Steve, just a really quick plug for our training plans that you can find on scientifictriathlon.com. I got this testimonial from Ron, who used a low-volume base training plan and rated it 10 out of 10. He wrote, it's better to train a few hours less but be consistent than to force the extra hours. Nobody can predict the future, but be realistic about stress of job and life demands. With this plan, my VO2 max went up from 52 to 60. So that's actually a scenario that is, it wasn't intentionally that I used this testimonial. It was just the latest one that came in. But it works quite well with Matteo's question because the low volume base training plan is 6 to 8 hours of training per week. I think it averages 7. So, check out our training plans on scientifictriathlon.com. Now, the next question is from Steve, who writes, hi, Michael. Thanks for putting so much triathlon scientific information together and for the podcast. In episodes 440 and 399, you have discussed testing carbon shoes and the most accessible test of using a heart rate monitor and a treadmill. Do you know any study suggesting a similar test by using a running power meter? And what is your opinion on this? Cheers, Steve. Thank you so much for your question, Steve. It's a really good one because I remember when running power meters were first coming out and there was a lot of buzz around them. And I was also really excited about them. One of the things that was talked about a lot was that basically you could use that as a proxy for running economy. But how the running power meters work is that they're not actually measuring power. They're calculating and approximating power using algorithms that are based on accelerometer data and things like that. So even barometric pressure and all sorts of things come into play. There's a lot of data coming in and it's quite sophisticated. So I'm absolutely not trying to say that they're not good. But one thing, and they also do estimate a spring constant. It's Stride calls it the leg spring stiffness, I believe, or at least they used to call it that. And that basically represents the elastic energy return that you get from your tendons. It's stored in your tendons and then you release it every step. And so they are, in a way, they're trying to do everything they can so that in theory you should be able to do this, use the power meter. Basically, you would use less power to run the same speed if you were in a pair of shoes that were more economical for you, right? The problem here is that the algorithms are algorithms that estimate something. They are black boxes. We don't know exactly how they work, and they are not exactly measuring what we need to know. So they're just approximating it based on the accelerometer data. So, and we don't know how accurate this estimation is, at least when it comes to things like the leg spring stiffness. So how much of the power that you're seeing is actually power rather than elastic energy return. They give you an estimate, but you don't know how accurate that is. So to give an example, if you start wearing a pair of shoes that give you a lot more energy return, thanks to the better foam and the carbon plate, then you cannot know for sure. And you're, let's say that you're giving a fixed input, a fixed effort, you're running at a fixed effort or a fixed metabolic power, then you will go faster with the faster pair of shoes that have the better foam and a better carbon plate. But we don't know whether Stride will fully be able to calculate, or another running power meter will be fully able to see that all of that extra speed actually comes from the shoes, from the elastic energy return rather than from metabolic power. Whether they will see that partially but not completely, or whether they won't see that at all, you just cannot know. There's no study on this, to my knowledge, on the leg spring stiffness constant, which is the key here, or the elastic energy in general. So in other words, you might see that you're going faster for the same effort and your power meter reads higher. You're getting a higher power number because Stride or the other power meter that you're using thinks that you're putting more effort in, but you're not putting more effort in. It's just a shoe helping you get more output. So for this reason, because you don't know whether it's like not at all or fully or partially that Stride can detect these things, heart rate is what is the most reliable option. And that is what I still recommend. I don't recommend using running power for this. There are, to be clear, studies on Stride and that they show that it correlates well with metabolic power, very well. But correlating very well is not the same as being very accurate and be able to accurately differentiate something like 0.5% improvement in run economy or 1% improvement in run economy that you get from one shoe to the other. And I'm not saying that I cannot exactly quantify the heart rate, but what I've seen is that the more well-trained you are, especially, and you can have stable heart rate across a session, then even a 1 to 2 beat per minute difference is consistent with what you actually find with a metabolic cart and actually measuring run economy. I have limited data. I haven't conducted a study. So this is all anecdotal, but this is why I choose heart rate, because I think that it has quite good sensitivity here. And honestly, if you're within 1 beat per minute, then how big is the economy difference going to be? It's not going to be big. Again, this comes from actually doing that economy testing in the lab as well. And so yeah, I think that generally heart rate is able to capture the differences. The limitation to my anecdotal data on this is that I don't know what happens when you have less fit athletes that maybe are not able to hold as stable a heart rate across a testing session. So I have to acknowledge that there are probably a bunch of other limitations as well. That's not what the question is about, though. So, and I have talked about this, like Steve said, in previous episodes. So you can go back and listen to those. But yeah, stride or running power meters in general is not something that I would recommend for this purpose. That's not to say that they're not useful, but not for shoe testing, in my mind. Thank you to Precision Full Hydration for sponsoring today's episode. Whether you're training for your first sprint triathlon, a marathon or trail running race, or a full Ironman, they make fueling and hydration practical and personalized. Their PF 30 and PF 90 gels give you reliable carbohydrate products with a neutral taste that you don't get flavor fatigue from. And the PF 30 caffeinated gel can give you that small additional performance kick that you might want at certain strategic points in the race. The Flow gel, on the other hand, is brilliant for holding a big volume of carbs in just one bottle on the bike, but even in a soft flask in longer running events like trail races or on the marathon in an Ironman. For hydration, they have drink mixes, and they have electrolyte tablets and sachets that you can tailor to your sweat sodium concentration. They also offer free video consultations that are available to anybody, regardless of whether you use Precision or not. And this is really an incredible offer. I personally made use of these consultations several times, and the athlete support team that deliver them really, really know their stuff. I've been super impressed every time. Go to precisionfuelhydration.com to book a consultation and use the code TTS2026 at checkout for 15% off your first order. Let's do one more question. And this one, and just to say that this is a short episode today, again, because I'm time crunched. This is my last day before traveling out tomorrow. And I actually have about 1 hour to get this episode recorded now and out there. Let's crack on. So Sam asks, Michael, I'm a longtime listener of the show and attribute a lot of my successes to information learned from listening to your show. Thank you. I really enjoyed your podcast on individualization of intensity targets. What I found most interesting was the recommendations of tailoring intensity targets to the athlete's glycolytic capacity and fiber typology. I'm a 23-year-old Ironman triathlete training towards a sub-9 Ironman. I have a VO2 max of 83 and a VLA max in the 0.6 to 0.7 range. I am a punchy athlete and definitely have quite a large glycolytic capacity and fast twitch contribution. For example, my 5K time is 15:10, but my half marathon is 1:16, indicating a weakness in longer sustained efforts. I'm in the process of trying to reduce my VLA max using high torque and sweet spot work during my upcoming build phase. My question to you is, how, as an athlete with higher glycolytic capacity, can I best tailor my training to be better at sustained efforts, improving my muscular endurance and durability? Thanks so much in advance, and thanks again for all the amazing, interesting work that you do. Best wishes, Sam. So, Sam, first of all, thank you for your question. And secondly, I think that your profile is a really amazing starting point for becoming a great endurance athlete across from sprint distance to Ironman, because obviously the high VO2 max is the most important one to have there. But having a high VLA max isn't bad either. You just have to tune your physiology over time. And yes, you can reduce the VLA max quickly, but you can do a lot of it over time. You can reduce it a little bit quickly and a lot over time, let's say. But even when you reduce it over time, you'll probably still always be able to find another gear that other athletes that are more diesel engines will struggle to find. And this can be really helpful in key moments of competitive races. So from the perspective of as a coach, if I were to design an ideal athlete profile that I could work with long term, then the profile that you have of somebody with a high VO2 max and a high VLA max is, in my opinion, one that has super high potential. And you just need to do the right work over time. And then it's probably the better profile, the profile that I would choose above somebody with a high VO2 max and really low VLA max. For sure it is, in fact. But to your question, how do you actually, what type of training do you do to become better at those sustained efforts when you have such a high VLA max? For listeners not familiar, VLA max, if you search VLA max on scientifictriathlon.com, you'll find a lot of episodes on it. It's a less talked about metric for sure, but it's basically the glycolytic capacity. And a high VLA max is something that somebody who is very punchy has a good top end has, but it also reduces high VLA max also reduces a bit your ability to hold a high power over longer sustained efforts for the same VO2 max, if that makes sense. And in Sam's case here, yes, you do have a big discrepancy between your 5K time and your half marathon time. In fact, it's a very big discrepancy, I would say. If your cycling is anywhere similar to that, then I absolutely agree that you need to work on those longer sustained efforts and improve that for any endurance event, but especially for something like an Ironman. Well, not any endurance event, not for a 5K, because your 5K time is great. Or it seems to be good enough for that, although you could also look at your 3K time or your mile time and maybe it would be even more competitive there. Who knows? But your goal now is Ironman, so we'll focus on that. It's important here, like I said, to understand that while you can do changes to VLA max in the short term, those are not big changes necessarily. They are small but important changes. But to fully turn into your best possible Ironman athlete, we're talking about a multi-year process in my experience. And the most important factor there is your training volume. I think that athletes of your profile, you can do a high training volume, at least you can build up to it, but you need to keep the endurance training easier at a relatively lower intensity than somebody with a diesel profile would. So we're talking really easy training, basically all of it in zone one. And this is how you will be able to stack training week in, week out, and month in and month out. And that's the number one biggest difference maker for you in the long term. And you should apply it in the short term as well. It will make a difference for the Ironman World Championships. You still might need a bit more recovery than an equivalent diesel profile, so a bit more frequent, slightly easier weeks or periods of 3-4 days of easier training. But I wouldn't say that you shouldn't exaggerate with that. It's a general advice that I know I've given many times, that more fast twitch athletes need that. But you can actually train surprisingly similar, I think, to a more slow twitch dominant athlete by just tweaking the training parameters. So how hard is your endurance training? Make it easy enough. And also potentially slightly reducing the frequency of your intense sessions, but also equally importantly or more importantly, the intensity control of your intense sessions. That's really important for you, and we'll get to that. But that being said, even though you might not need to have you don't need to over-worry about resting more necessarily or having more deload periods. But when you feel that you are getting tired, listen to your body. Don't be afraid to give yourself a couple of easy days. This is advice that is true for any athlete, of course. But I think that the consequences are a bit graver for the more fast twitch dominant athletes than diesel athletes. Basically, you can get away with more. Mistakes are less costly with a diesel type athlete than with a fast twitch dominant athlete, in my experience again. Then you mentioned the high torque work and the sweet spot work, and they're classic examples of the things that you can do to reduce VLA max, especially in the short term. I think they work. And not just in the short term, in the short and long term, but these are the types of interventions that are often talked about because they work maybe a bit more quickly than the other things I mentioned, like volume. Sweet spot is, in my opinion, just threshold work for you. You don't even need to think about any other type of threshold work, basically, because for you, you want to keep your threshold training at a slightly lower intensity level to make sure that you're not recruiting too much fast twitch muscle fibers and accumulating too much lactate. So anytime you see threshold in a program, you can just think sweet spot, basically, and that's where you go. And torque training, I'll admit, it's a constant source of annoyance for me because there isn't really so good evidence for it. But that being said, anecdotally, with athletes of your profile, I have seen it work repeatedly well or even very well. So I would advise doing it. And when you do it, focusing mainly on intensities between tempo and sweet spot, maybe more so going up to sweet spot, but some tempo work at high torque, low cadence is also not a bad thing to include. And you probably need to do very little VO2 max work, but I would do it every once in a while just to maintain it. And rather than doing complete sessions, you might integrate it into your other sessions. So for example, you could start a sweet spot session by doing a couple of VO2 max reps early on. And when you do this, so in contrast to more diesel-oriented, diesel-type athletes, diesel-type profiles, I recommend doing longer reps for your VO2 max work, so maybe 3 to 4 minutes, even 5 minutes potentially of intervals, because otherwise you might not really move your oxygen uptake enough to approach VO2 max, because you can just burn through so much of your anaerobic capacity in shorter reps, like the classic 30-15s or 40-20s or things like that. So an example might be that you could do a session where you start with 2 by 3 minutes of VO2 max intensity with basically going sort of best effort or close to best effort. Not quite. At your profile, sorry, it should be probably be more like 90% effort or 95% effort rather than best effort, which I would say for more of a diesel-oriented athlete. Take 1-to-1 work to rest ratio, so 3 minutes rest there. And then after those 2 times 3 minutes, you head into a set of a few 15-minute sweet spot intervals. So you basically just do maintenance VO2 max work that leads into the main session. And that should be enough to maintain your VO2 max, because I don't think you need to do too much in terms of complete sessions necessarily. And that might also, if you do that, if you do too much, you might basically contradict, or that stimulus is going to also contribute to maybe VLA max increasing, or at least not going down the way that you'd like it to. And then a couple of other things. I generally recommend slightly longer and more aggressive tapers for athletes of your profile. This has got nothing to do with you getting better at sustained effort, but just with you performing better in races, because I think for athletes with a more fast twitch profile, you do benefit a bit more from really resting and making sure that you're fresh rather than fit at the start line, if that makes sense. And I would also usually do work to rest ratios that are one step easier than with an equivalent athlete of a diesel profile. So for example, my standard work to rest ratio for sweet spot intervals for most athletes would be 4-to-1. So 20 minutes of work, 5 minutes of rest, for example. But for athletes of your profile, the 4-to-1 ratio would be 3-to-1 instead. So one step easier. And that means 15 minutes of work to 5 minutes of rest. And the same would apply also for threshold work, VO2 max work, and so on and so forth, tempo work. Basically, this is to allow better intra-workout recovery and reduce the risk of overreaching. It's not such a big deal, but I found that to be helpful. And like I said, you might need to do less frequent intense workouts than the equivalent diesel profile would. So I don't know anything about your actual training volume and how often you train intensity, but I assume that you're a fairly advanced athlete given your goal times and your physiological numbers. So I assume that you train a reasonable amount and a reasonable amount of intensity. But for example, if an equivalent diesel athlete to you might do 2 hard swims, 2 hard bikes, and 2 hard runs in a week, you might only need to do, let's say, 2 hard swims, one hard bike, and 1 hard run. And that would be perfectly fine and allow you to recover better if you struggle to do that between intense sessions. But also, I would say that just like with volume, you might actually find that if you're good enough at intensity control, then you can actually do a similar amount of frequency of intense sessions compared to a diesel profile, because intensity control in sessions is going to be such a critical part much more important for you than for that sort of diesel profile athlete, somebody with a low VLA max. But if you do get it right, then you can do a lot of things quite similarly to an athlete of that different profile and potentially even accelerate your improvement. So that's, yeah. I guess if you take two things away from this is, or three things away from this, it's the key driver is just a good amount of low intensity volume. Secondly, most of your intense training should be sweet spot or below. And thirdly, intensity control in those intense sessions and in the endurance sessions, by the way. Intensity control is key to your recovery and you being able to adapt to the training. And this is going to be much more critical for you than for somebody with a low VLA max. So I hope this helps, Sam, and I hope this helps other listeners as well. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com/TTS702. And while you're there, check out more information about our training plans, coaching, and also you can check out the podcast episode archives. You can categorize, look at different categories of episodes and find what interests you. If you want to get your questions answered on a future Q&A, please email me your question at any time on michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and that's Michael with a K. And finally, very briefly, if you do enjoy the podcast, please support it in one of the following ways. Number one, by supporting our partners, Ruvi, Effortless Swimming, and Precision Fuel Hydration. You can find the discount codes at the bottom of the episode description. Two, by sharing the podcast with people that you think might be interested. And three, by engaging with the Spotify poll and comments and with the YouTube comments. All of those things really help a lot. And I really appreciate it. Your support and help is what makes it possible to keep bringing you the podcast every week. And I really appreciate it more than I can say. I'll see you next Thursday with another episode. Until then, thank you as always for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.